The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by your university system, including Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn more.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today oversees a state agency that touches so many parts of outdoor life in New Hampshire, fish and game. And while the department does serve hunters and anglers, it also oversees backcountry, search and rescue, habitat protection, boat launches, endangered species, and more. And given how passionately Granite Staters feel about wildlife and our outdoor spaces, it's a job that requires solid diplomatic and political skills. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Fish and Game's new executive director, Scott Mason. And listeners, what questions about Fish and Game's broad portfolio do you have? How do you see its work affecting our state? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or call 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. And Scott Mason, welcome to The Exchange. It's great to have you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, as I said, this is a hard job. Lots of conflicts about hunting, about land use, about ATVs, about who's on the Fish and Game Commission itself. What drew you to this position, Director Mason?
Well, the Fish and Game Commission and the governor were in the process of trying to get a new commissioner. I did not put my name out there on the first try. And when they went back to come up with a new list of candidates, my name surfaced, the ex-chairman of the Fish and Game Commission surfaced my name. And one of the commissioners, the chairman of the search committee, came and talked to me about it. And at that point, I decided to put my name in.
Oh, wow. Okay. So the former director, Glenn Normando, said...
No, former chair of the commission.
Oh, I see. I see. Well, you started in August of 2020, yep. You know, in the middle of a pandemic. You come onto this job with a huge array of responsibilities, 200 employees, you know, kind of scattered at Fish and Game sites all over the state. What was that like to start a new challenging job in an especially challenging time?
It certainly added a layer of awkwardness to getting out and meeting folks. Coming out of my agricultural background, I understood how important it was to make sure that we maintained our staff around the hatcheries and whatnot. So although I did get out and visit each one of the hatcheries, I was trying to do that at times when the infection rates were lower. And I haven't really been able, because of COVID, I have not been out interacting with, you know, my far-flung staff as much as I would like to have done at this point. It was kind of funny, you know, you start off with a new job like this, the first thing you think about doing is getting out and meeting all your staff. And,
right.
And, you know, we had quite a few staff that were working from home. That's fairly recently changed. And I'm now looking at new faces at headquarters that I haven't met before. So it is certainly an interesting time to come on as director.
Well, how did the pandemic affect the work of your agency?
Well, and I think everybody knows about it. With people staying home, one of the first things a lot of folks did was decide they wanted to get out and enjoy nature. License sales dramatically increased. Registration on OHRV and snowmobiles dramatically increased. The number of hikers dramatically increased. So we saw surges in OHRV and snowmobile accidents, which impact time you know, our COs end up having to investigate those and make reports on those. And then also increases in lost hikers and a little bit more search and rescue work than what we normally do.
Go ahead.
I apologize.
No, I was just going to say, we heard last summer, you know, just so much about people getting out hiking and ATVing and so forth. And that did increase, you know, the search and rescue functions. Go ahead, Director Mason.
Well, I was going to add is we are now in our spring turkey hunt, and we are on par with where we were last year as far as the number of birds harvested. So some states, I guess what I'm suggesting is our herds and flocks are in good shape, and we're able to handle having a few extra animals taken during last year's hunting season.
Well, and I read that hunting and fishing license sales also went up. I think fishing license sales went up by something like 40% last year, Director Mason.
Yeah. One of the issues with hunting is you have to have you have to go through a hunter safety class. So if you haven't done that, you got to accomplish that. And we were trying to accomplish hunter safety with an online program and field day. And some folks liked it, some folks didn't. So it may have created a stumbling block to folks actually going hunting for the first time.
Well, and your agency and many of the agencies that, again, deal with people, you know, in New Hampshire's great outdoors, learned a lot last year, were very busy last year because of the forces that you just mentioned. So how do you hope to capitalize on all the attention that our outdoor spaces received last year and maybe sort of work with the crowds a little bit more, I don't want to say better, but more knowledgeably, given what we saw last year?
Well, one of the first things we did this fall, is we have been meeting and working with our friends over at Department of Natural Resources, the State Parks, the Trails Bureau, and we're trying to, we're trying to bring our staffs together to meet not only at the commissioner level, but at some of the lower levels and all the way up through to discuss some of the issues that has impacted all of us. And trying to figure out ways that we can work better with limited resources that we have. Trying to improve our communications with constituency groups that are out there enjoying the outdoors to get safety messages out. That's where we started the program.
Improve messages with constituency groups. So give me an example of what you mean there, Director Mason.
Oh, just better press releases. And one of the things we ran into last year, another issue we ran into was, this isn't really a fish and game issue, but we had a lot of people that were illegally camping. A lot of the campgrounds were closed. So people showed up and just went camping. Now, when you're in Pittsburgh on ground that Fish and Game owns, then it does become one of our issues. So we had to deal with it. But one of the things that popped up was not only was it illegal camping, but just folks not having good campfire practices. And we never had a campfire. We didn't have any campfires got out of control, but it certainly was a bit of a concern for our COs and some of our folks working that ground.
Yeah, well, especially with last year's drought. And COs is conservation officers, right, Director Mason?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. Listeners, we are talking about New Hampshire's Fish and Game Department today, all the things that it does. And we're sitting down with the new executive director, Scott Mason, today. He started in August of last year. What questions do you have about how this agency operates and its wide impact on our state? Let us know by email to exchange@nhpr.org or with a phone call to 800-892-6477. And Director Mason, lots of people already writing in by email and calling in. Let's take Richard in Whitefield. Hi, Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Director Mason. This is in regards to some off-trail riding, snowmobiling, and I do go out west and ride on state lands. and pay the fees and everything that goes along with it, the expense of traveling. And I was wondering whether New Hampshire would be considering any options for off-trail riding, if you've noticed all the snowmobilers that are buying these sleds. The market is turning towards it, trending away from trail riding, not to down trail riding, but it isn't everybody's game. And I just was wondering whether the state of New Hampshire would have any future looking into allowing for off-trail riding.
Oh, wow. Okay, Richard, thank you very much for calling in. Go ahead, Director Mason.
Well, there's some differences, obviously, between the East Coast and out West. Most of our trails and most of the riding opportunities that we have in New Hampshire are actually on private property. And, you know, law in New Hampshire is you can't be on somebody's property without written permission unless you have, you know, unless you're riding one of these trails that where somebody is, you know, the local club has set up an agreement with the landowners. So I really don't see a future in it for New Hampshire. The one possibility would be the National Forest, and I don't believe that they would have a desire to open their lands up to off-trail riding like that. But I can't speak for them. Most of the lands that Fish and Game owns, we own them for habitat reasons, and I'm not too sure that off-trail riding would fit into the reasons why we own the land that we own. Dancer owns some land, and they, once again, I'm not too sure how that would fit into their management scheme of their properties.
Richard, thank you for the question. So it doesn't sound like, anytime, Richard should not expect this anytime soon, Director.
Right. Whereas out West, you know, a large chunk of the land out there is either owned by National Forest or the Department of Interior. And so you're riding on public lands when you're out
there. I see.
On a lot
okay.
of it versus All right, what we ride difference. On here. Or, you know, you got a 100,000 acre ranch that allows for it, you know.
Dr. Mason, earlier you mentioned that one of the impacts of the pandemic last summer was a bunch of people going outdoors, and you guys had to do, you know, more search and rescues because of that. Nancy sent us an email saying, according to the Fish and Game website, search and rescue missions comprise 21% of expenditures. How much is being reimbursed by those who need rescuing and don't have a hike safe card? And Nancy, I'm glad you wrote. First of all, Director Mason, just remind us what the hike safe card is. And then to answer her question about, you know, are people who get these expensive rescues, you know, helping to cover the costs?
Well, what a hike safe card is, if you're thinking of enjoying hiking in the state of New Hampshire, you can purchase a hike safe card, and it actually acts like insurance. So that if something happens and you need to be rescued, or, you know, we need to come find you, there's no accompanying fee for it. We still go out and rescue folks. I mean, things happen to, you know, to good folks, and we don't necessarily charge for every rescue, even if there isn't a hike safe card there. But when we get out there and you've done something that common sense, you know, and good practice would say you shouldn't have gotten into that position, you shouldn't have found yourself in that position, then we do charge for the cost of the rescues. Last year, I think we billed on 12 rescues.
You billed on 12 rescues, and did you get
right.
paid on 12 rescues?
I am not sure. We're still in the process of collecting. One of the issues comes in is trying to collect that money. There is a law in the state that allows us that if you're not, it can go against your driver's license if you don't pay the bill. And that's helpful. It's just a matter of activating that as we go forth.
Well, thanks for that email, Nancy. And I wanted to ask you, Director Mason, about climate change. And I know this is sort of embedded in all the work that you guys are doing. I've been looking at your reports and so forth, and it comes up a lot. Just broadly at first, how do you see climate change affecting the fish and animals that your agency is overseeing? You know, what are you hearing from your biologists in the field?
Yeah. Well, of course, every species it's going to have a varying impact on. One of the issues, and some species are more adaptable than others. And by nature, an endangered species, part of the issue is they're less adaptable than other right. species are. For example, you know, you live in a suburban area, you can look out on your front lawn some days and you can see a deer chewing on, you know, chewing on your shrubs. And that, you know, deer have become, you know, they're very adaptable to living in and around humans. Coyotes have done the same thing. So some species are very adaptable, and same would apply, or, you know, it may not be the same species, but the adaptability of species to climate change, you know, it will impact some different than others. We're currently working, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and several of the Atlantic coast states are working on a project right now on, salt marsh sparrow. And this is a bird that, you know, is threatened and is threatened by, you know, decline of habitat in the first place. But this habitat that the bird lives in and has to live in is our coastal marshes. And these coastal marshes are going to be some of the first victims as the sea level rises.
Oh, that's interesting. I was just talking to some Audubon folks a week or so ago, and one of their biggest concerns is the saltwater birds. Since you're mentioning, you know, marine life and birds that live near the water, I wonder about freshwater fish, Director Mason, especially with last year's drought. I remember driving by some streams that, you know, were just completely dry.
Looked a little dry
last summer. Yeah. How were these populations affected? Do we know yet?
No, I don't think, at least I have not seen any studies come forth over my desk yet. We will be out doing some electric fishing in some of those brooks just to check and see what happened with some of the numbers. It can have a local impact, but some of the work we've done in let's use wild brook trout as an example. You know, we've maintained a wild brook trout population in this state year after year after year. And it's, you know, obviously as the habitat converted into development in the southern part of the state, it, you know, we have less wild brook trout population in the southern part, but we actually have, we found wild trout in the city of Manchester.
Oh, wow.
So they're there, and they do survive when the brooks get dry like that. You know, a certain amount of fish will find a cool spot somewhere in that brook, and they will survive.
Well, we got an email from Mike and Keen about trout stocking. Actually, he says, it seems the stocking reports are delayed this year, currently a few weeks behind. Mike wants to know, when might these be updated? Any reason for the delay?
Well, probably a good reason. Right now we're short our inland, fisheries chief. So we're running a little, we're running a little short staffed. And so that's probably the reason why we haven't been keeping up with our reports as far as the stocking.
All right, Mike, good to hear from you. Let's take another call. Director Mason, Mike's calling from Manchester. Hi, Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good, good. So I've got a question. I just recently, last fall and now this spring, riding an electric Class 1 mountain bike. And there doesn't seem to be much information about where we're allowed to ride. Are we allowed to ride on all of the typical bike trails? And are we allowed to ride in, you know, just out in the forest with these? Again, a Class 1 mountain bike is one that, in most states, is allowed to ride where all other bikes can be ridden. But they do change from state to state, and I don't have much clarity on this situation.
Wow. Mike, thanks for calling. And Director Mason, this may be more a question for the Bureau of Trails, but can you enlighten us at all on whether mountain bikes, will be allowed on trails?
Yeah. It actually is. That would be a question with the Trails Bureau and how they set up their programs. I will say this. We have a person that works for us that deals with landowner. We call it landowner outreach. And we had a major landowner in the state of New Hampshire. And one of the things they do is that, you know, they go out to try to solve problems on private property. You know, if we have somebody that's experienced, you know, a hunter, we call them slob hunters. We try to work to maintain open space in New Hampshire and availability of allowing sportsmen to use private property. And this one large landowner had requested, it's the first time to my knowledge, but has requested us to build specialty signs saying no wheeled vehicles beyond this point. And specifically, this landowner was complaining about mountain bikes utilizing his property without asking permission.
That's a common theme, isn't it? Yeah, with ATVs, well, and, you know, snowmobiles.
In New Hampshire,
bikes.
We have the right to trespass. You know, without a trespass sign, you know, that you can go on somebody's property. But we do teach, you know, in hunter safety, it was a big part of the class, is that if you're going to be out there hunting on somebody's property, even though you have the, you know, legal right to be there if they don't have a sign, it's always best to ask. And I think it's the same thing with these trail bikes, you know, your electric bike or even a mountain bike. If you're not on a designated trail that allows it and you're on somebody's private property, it's my recommendation to you that you ask permission before you end up there.
Mike, it's good to hear from you. Thank you for calling in. Again, our number is 800-892-6477. One more question, Director Mason, about climate change and the impact on some key New Hampshire species. We have done probably a dozen shows at least over the years on the plight of New Hampshire's moose populations struggling as a result of increased tick populations. What's their status right now, Director Mason?
Well, we manage them in different geographical areas, and the tick infestation that you're referring to with the moose is dense. The worst of it is up in the northern part of the state, and the actual band of tick infestation actually goes above us into Canada too. So the herds up there have been taking a, you know, we no longer have the size of the herd that we once did back in the 90s. We do not have the number of animals. I don't, you know, if you've ever had the opportunity to see a moose that's infested with ticks, it is a very sobering thing to see. It is not a pleasant way to you know, these moose are suffering terribly.
Yeah, very thin, ghost moose,
very
I
thin.
Think they call them. Yeah.
Well, they become very anemic. You know, if you check out a carcass or whatnot, you open up their mouth or their lips and their gums and everything are white because they've lost so much blood.
So why hunt moose at all? I think Fish and Game is giving out like 40 some odd permits this year. If they're struggling so much, why not just leave them alone?
Well, one of the concepts that is being developed, and right now both all three states, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, are coming to this conclusion and are following a path on it. If we can reduce the amount of moose, we might be able to reduce the amount of ticks in the area. And then the moose would be able to recover with less ticks in the area. And it may just become a cyclic problem for us.
Yeah, longtime moose biologist Christine Rhines, who I think retired last year or the year before, had also talked about that. Seems in a way counterintuitive, but the fewer moose there are, the fewer hosts the ticks have. And so the hope is at least that the population rebounds. Director Mason, we have to take a very quick station break. But when we come back, a lot more questions from our listeners about boat ramps, about diversity among fish and game staff, about some of the hunting practices that people engage in here in New Hampshire. And we'll talk more about Fish and Game's budget, where the bulk of the money comes from. So much more to talk about after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking with Scott Mason. He's the Executive Director of New Hampshire's Fish and Game Department, an agency that serves not only hunters and anglers, but also oversees habitat management, endangered species, search and rescue, and, as we've been hearing, much more. What questions about Fish and Game's many activities do you have? What is the impact of its work on our state's outdoor spaces? How do you see it? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 800-892-6477. So, Director Mason, I have a couple emails here about the Fish and Game Commission itself. Who sits on it? Who does not? Jack in Claremont says, currently a member of the Fish and Game Commission must have a hunting, fishing, or trapping license for at least two of the last 5 years. The commission, therefore, is made up of these so-called sportsmen, Jack says, people who want to enjoy our state's wildlife by hiking, riding ATVs, photography, etc., are not represented, yet the commission regulates their use of our wilderness. Do you think the requirements for commissioners should be changed to allow representation of those people who enjoy our fish and wildlife, but don't hunt, fish, or trap? And then Nancy has a similar email. She says 25% of fish and game income comes from federal funds, not associated with hunting, trapping, fishing. Isn't it time, Nancy says, to include non-consumptive users on the commission? New Hampshire's population is changing, and state agencies who control policy should reflect all citizens, not just holders of certain licenses. So whenever we talk about fish and game, we always get this question, Director Mason. I'd love your thoughts there. Time to open up membership on the Fish and Game Commission.
First of all, that's a legislative decision, not one that's within my purview. My personal opinion on it is I think the Fish and Game Commission has served New Hampshire fish and game well over the years. Yes, you have to have a hunting, fishing, or trapping license to be considered on the commission. But that doesn't mean that's the only way you enjoy the outdoors in New Hampshire. And we have a wide variety of commissioners that participate in multiple different methods of enjoying the outdoors. Just because somebody has a hunting license doesn't mean they don't also have a kayak. It doesn't mean that they don't have, a camera and enjoy wildlife viewing. So I think it's a bit of a argument that when you really start looking at the people that are involved and the decisions that the commission's making, I don't think it plays out the way some of these folks would like to see the commission changed.
So keep it the way it is. You got to have that hunting or fishing license.
Yeah.
Would it create broader public support for fish and game if the commission were broadened? And again, this has come up time and time again. Nancy says, you're controlling outdoor policy that should reflect all citizens, she says, not just holders of certain licenses.
Fish and game only controls, the commission specifically controls very few outdoor policies in the state of New Hampshire. So we're not controlling all of the policy. The commission itself does not control all of the outdoor policies in the state of New Hampshire. Would there be more, broad support for fish and game? I think there is fairly broad support for fish and game and the role that we play in the state. It's just New Hampshire's New Hampshire, and every nickel gets squozed twice before it gets spent.
In terms of the staff, you mentioned earlier you were down a staff member. What staff member was it again? Something to do with...
Chief of Inland Fisheries.
Fisheries, right. We got an email from someone who didn't give a name who says, I'm a UNH student and I understand there is only one female conservation officer. I'm wondering what the director is doing to improve representation among the staff. What do you think, Director Mason?
We only have the comments right. We only have one female CO. We are in the process right now of hiring three new COs, and you know, we take applications. There's a test, and then there's a physical test, and I believe there are still two women in the pool, and we will see how that continues, you know, through the process. The next process is, you know, oral examination.
What about representation of women and people of color on the commission itself? That's been another longtime criticism of the commission, that it's largely white men.
Yeah. The governor just nominated two new commissioners yesterday at the council meeting, both of which happen to be women.
Okay. I had not heard about that yet. Thank you for that email to that person from UNH. Again, our number is 800-892-6477 and our email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's take another call. This is Alan calling from Sullivan County. Hi, Alan. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, Dr. Mason. How are you all?
Fine. Go ahead, Alan.
So I'm a fourth generation fisherman in the state of New Hampshire, proudly. Our surname has 30 licenses year after year after year after year. It's a great, great state. My question is about fees and fines. So if we look at a fishing license only with a saltwater tag and we look at the cost of surrounding states, New Hampshire is, I think, disproportionately high. So when we can go to Maine and get an annual fishing license, or Vermont, and get an annual fishing license for less money than a resident license, is Fish and Game looking at that disparity, or is part of your funding, you know, why is it so different?
And if I could ask you, Alan, what kind of fines are you talking about? Like illegal fishing?
So this is the fees for purchasing a fishing license.
That's right, I get that.
Question. Fines, yeah. Fines is a follow-up. So we're big fans of North Country Law that puts New Hampshire Fish and Game, along with others in the region, on television. And I think fines that are levied, at least the ones that we see on television, seem embarrassingly low for an offense to our great state and its resources.
I see. Okay, Alan, thank you for calling. So the fees for licenses, he seems to be saying, Director Mason, are too high, and the fines for people who disobey the law when they're out there fishing or hunting are too low. Just to add into Alan's comment, Brian also posted on Facebook, he loves Northwood's Law. Jennifer in Northwood, her family's a huge fan of Northwood Law. She wants to know about plans to continue that show. So you can address that in a minute. But what about the fees and fines, Director Mason?
Okay. What I can't speak to is the funding levels in the state of Vermont or Maine as far as how much of their money is coming out of their general fund. All of the different states have access to federal money. The difference between the different states is how much money state taxpayers pay into the system versus, you know, what in between the different states. New Hampshire gets very little out of the general fund. We are license based to make the payments. One of the little known facts, our waters are just not as productive as the waters to the east or the west of us. It's the same as the farmland. You know, you travel in Vermont, you still see a lot of land that's being farmed. New Hampshire, you see less. Maine, the same thing. We're nicknamed the Granite State. So in order to give folks the fishing experience that they would like with trout, we end up stocking a lot more trout. So We have probably a little bit more expensive fishing program here in New Hampshire than they do in Maine or Vermont in order to give folks the experience that they're looking for.
Oh, that's interesting. So it costs you more to maintain it. What about the fines? Could those be increased? Alan seems to think,
you know, they're set by the legislature. And it is something that we do look at from time to time. My understanding, and I've never gone through the process, so I can't really speak for the legislature, but I think there's been a history where they've not wanted to have high fines.
Yeah, well, and
we run into the same issue on ATVs and snow machine fines.
To all the people who are fans of Northwoods Law, Jennifer wants to know, you know, she says it's a great vehicle to showcase New Hampshire Fish and Game and our state. Is the plan to continue with the show? Jennifer, thanks for writing. Director Mason?
We certainly would like to continue with the show. Right now, a lot of what is shown on the show is the activities of our COs. I would like to expand that. We have some really nifty stuff going on in the non-game area of the department, and I would really like to get some of that onto the Northwoods Law.
Well, Janice and Grantham writes to that effect. She says, please tell us about the non-game and endangered wildlife division and its programs. I mean, that's a big question, but could you just give us an overview? And just that tells folks that you're not just doing hunting. There's non-game and endangered species
right.
as well.
No, we have a non-game. It's a subdivision within the wild game division. So wild game is game, non-game, and habitat is what consists of our wildlife division. And the non-game folks deal with a lot of the endangered species and threatened species. We have active programs right now where we're New England Cottontail Program, where we're trying to breed cottontails to try to improve the numbers of these New England cottontails that are left. We also have several butterfly programs that we're working on. One, the Carner Blue here in the Concord area. And then we have another program that's up on Mount Washington with a butterfly up there. It's one of the few locations in the world, this butterfly. This butterfly is only found in the White Mountains. And it's kind of a unique opportunity for us. We also, a lot of work, and you see a lot of stuff about some of our turtle programs and some of the wetlands around. And then, of course, the rattlesnake.
I didn't even know we had rattlesnakes in New Hampshire.
Yeah,
I'm kind of bummed.
I
thought that was just an out west thing.
My rattlesnake biologist is trying to get me, wants to get me out and about and introduce me to a couple of her best friends that happen to be rattlesnakes. So,
okay.
Better
you than me, Director Mason.
That's next week.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, more on hunting. We have some questions about possums and ruffled grouse. Also, folks want to know about boat ramps, so we'll talk about that coming out of a very short break. Keep your calls coming in, too. The number is 800-892-6477, and the email is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with the Executive Director of New Hampshire Fish and Game, Scott Mason. And Exchange listeners, it's been great to hear from you, your comments and questions about the work Fish and Game does with wildlife, habitat, hunting, fishing, search and rescue, ATVs, snowmobiles, and a lot more. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our number is 800-892-6477. And Director Mason, right back to our listeners. Bob and Sullivan says, can you explain, please, why opossums, squirrels, and otters are being hunted? These animals are not being eaten. Their fur doesn't have any value. Bob says this seems like wanton waste to me. I find it especially confusing that opossum are being killed because one of their functions in our ecosystem is eating ticks, which they do a very good job of. Why kill an animal that helps to prevent Lyme disease? Bob, thank you very much for writing. And Director Mason, go ahead.
So he's referencing we don't have closed season. What were the species again? Opossum?
Opossum, squirrels, and otters, but especially opossum.
Well, we do have otters, I believe, are a regulated season. Squirrels, we regulate the season on gray squirrels, but we don't on red squirrels. Specifically on possums, I am not sure what the answer is as far as why we, you know, do or don't have a season on it, other than possibly the fact that possums are fairly, you know, it seems that they are a new and growing species for the state of New Hampshire.
Here's another question about why we hunt certain populations. And this person didn't give a name, asks, New Hampshire's ruffed grouse populations have been struggling for some time. The natural high-low cycles have seemingly been replaced by fairly static low numbers of birds. It's not a habitat issue alone that is the cause, this person says. We still have great habitat in the North Country and our populations are still poor. Can you talk about what New Hampshire Fish and Game is doing to study variables that affect grouse populations, such as West Nile virus and other factors? Okay, that's interesting. Thank you to that person for writing. And go ahead, Director Mason, please.
Well, one of the issues with the West Nile virus is I guess the mosquito that carries it doesn't prefer higher elevation habitats. So that, as far as the North Country impact, and everybody has their own definition of the North Country. Coming from Coos County, it starts, you know, above the notch. For a lot of people, it starts around Concord. So not knowing exactly this person's definition of the North Country, when you do get up into the North Country with higher elevations, they have not had the West Nile issue as much. We do have a program and we are constantly monitoring populations and impact to the bird. One of the things that we do a lot of times what is happening in New Hampshire is the same as what's happening in other states. So we do monitor and participate in a lot of regional approaches to research and monitoring research going on in other states.
Here's another question about trapping. And we've got a couple emails about trapping, but I'll share this one. Ron in Marlboro says, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Commission condones many acts that the majority of New Hampshire residents strongly object to, such as killing contests, bear baiting, bear hounding, unlimited hunting and trapping, while animals are raising young, which results in starving babies, Ron says, and trapping in general. Ron says, I am a hunter, but these practices do not seem sporting or ethical to me, and I don't do them. I think they give us all a bad name. How do you justify these acts, Ron says. Before you answer the question, just a point of fact, Director Mason, he says, animals, while animals are raising young, I thought hunting seasons were organized around sort of breeding seasons and giving birth seasons, and that you weren't allowed to kill animals while they were raising young.
Of the protected species, yes. He's probably referencing coyotes that do not have a protected season.
I see. Okay, that's an important point of clarification. So he's right about certain species that are not so-called protected. What about his broad question? He says he's a hunter, but these particular practices, you know, don't seem sporting, as he says. They give hunters a bad name. What do you think, Director Mason?
It's always interesting when you go, you take a group of deer hunters and they all have their own methodology of how they think, what they think is sporting for deer hunting. You know, do you allow baiting? Do you not allow baiting? Different methodologies. And I guess what I would suggest is that there are a lot of different people's opinions on this matter, and it's not as clear as what this gentleman is suggesting that it is. I think he was talking about bear baiting.
Yeah, that's often controversial.
There's a lot of hunters that bear bait. It's an enjoyable practice. It is an enjoyable way to hunt bear. There are some people would argue that what it does allow you to do is to choose, if you so choose to choose between sows and boars. Gives you an opportunity to view the animal before you actually decide to harvest.
Oh, I see. Because you don't want to kill a sow because a sow may be raising cubs.
Well, it has a bigger impact on the bear's, overall population by removing a sow versus a boar.
That's interesting. I saw in the strategic planning documents for Fish and Game that one goal is to increase the number of trappers in the state. Why is that, Director Mason? A lot of our listeners don't have a problem with hunting, but do have a problem with trapping. They feel like it's cool.
No, I understand. Trapping is about the only method that we have in controlling nuisance animals. Everybody enjoys a beaver until it causes a flood that has an economic impact on you. It's one thing to have your neighbor's house have a wet basement because of a beaver, but when it's your house that has the wet basement, all of a sudden you have a different opinion on beavers. And the truth of the matter is that the number of trappers each year are getting less and less. And yes, right now we do have a group of trappers that offer nuisance service calls and whatnot, but almost all of those folks started off as recreational trappers before they became nuisance trappers. And it's just an effort to try to maintain the skills associated with trapping that helps us manage some of these species that cause issues.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to address that because, again, we always hear from a lot of listeners on that issue. But I don't want to forget the fish side of your portfolio. We don't focus all on the game side. So here's a question from Don, who says, New Hampshire Fish and Game boat ramps and trails information is not managed on Google and Apple Maps. Are there any plans to actively keep this information that thousands of people use up to date? And boy, people really like knowing where those boat ramps are. Director Mason, I myself have, tried to figure out where's the closest boat ramp. I got the kayaks on the top of the car and I want to go somewhere.
Well, that's certainly a good thing for us to look into. This is the first anybody suggested this to me, but it's certainly a good idea.
Here's another email from this is John in Webster, who says people often.
Let me go back.
Well, sure, go ahead.
You can get on our webpage and get a list of where the boat accesses are, so you can electronically get it there. We also have maps of all lakes and ponds in the state of New Hampshire that are on our webpage that would actually show where the boat launches are on those ponds. But then, of course, for a lot of folks, a state highway map will show you where the boat launches are, too.
Okay. So if people want to know where these are, that information is there. It's just not on Google and Apple Maps. Is that right?
I'm unfamiliar. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I've never checked a Google map for a boat launch.
Yeah. Well, being the director of Fish and Game, maybe you already kind of have inside information on where those are. So, Don, thank you for writing. It's a good question. Here's an email from John in Webster, who says, people often wonder which wildlife organization they should donate to get the best bang for the buck. John says, please consider purchasing a hunting and or fishing license. Even if you don't actively participate in those activities, it's money well spent. So, John, thank you for the email.
Thank you, John.
What other main sources of revenue are there, Director Mason, for Fish and Game besides the licenses and the federal grants that one of our other listeners mentioned?
Well, we do get some general funding. We do have a program to donate to the non-game species program directly at Fish and Game. We have an organization called the Wildlife Foundation, and you can make donations to those folks, and then they in turn grant money to Fish and Game.
Well, John, thank you for writing in. I wanted to ask you about a bill in the legislature, Director Mason, stating that, and quoting here, basically that the outdoors is for everyone, quote, without fear of violence or discrimination. And the bill requires some employees at your agency to undergo ethics, diversity, and de-escalation training, among them you. What do you see as the benefit of this?
I apologize. I've not been involved as heavily as I should or as I normally would be in our legislative process. Senate Bill 114.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the number, but I was going through some of the legislation concerning Fish and Game yesterday.
Okay.
It's a broad,
Well, one of the issues with it, and I think they were targeting our COs, the way we train police officers in New Hampshire is all of the police officers get to go to police standards and training.
Including
conservation officers. So the problem was, I think they pulled out conservation officers and the foresters over at Dancer for this special training. And that becomes, that's a hard thing to accomplish versus having it as part of all officers training. And I think that bill, if I'm on the right bill, came from an incident at the Audubon where they had some racist graffiti on their property in an outdoor setting. And, to kind of prove what we were saying is, well, who did the Audubon call? And they called Concord City Police. And that's who they reported the incident to. So it's not something that should, in my opinion, it shouldn't be targeted just at the Fish and Game COs or the foresters. Making all police aware that there are occasionally some racist things that go on or said, or I should say, graffiti out in the field, and make them aware of the issue to try to deal with it more effectively and efficiently.
Well, and next week, we on The Exchange are going to be taking a broader look at police training, like you said, overall.
Yep.
So it gives me a chance to talk about that show that'll be coming up. Dale in Kearsarge writes, with the explosion of backcountry skiing over the past several years, have you seen an increase in rescues, or are snowmobile and winter hikers still the predominant rescues during the winter? Boy, Dale, you're right. Every other friend I have seemed to be doing backcountry skiing this year. So have you noticed that causing an increase in rescue situations, Director Mason?
I do not have a breakdown. What I ended up pulling was an average for 10 years. So I don't have a year-to-year breakdown in that. I know, I believe that a backcountry skier would be listed as a cross-country skier in our records. And that's only like 0.7% of our rescues in the last 10 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what are most of the rescues? Are they snowmobiles and ATVs or lost hikers?
Hikers. 62% of all of our rescues are hikers and climbers. Hunters, anglers, boaters, OHRV is about 10%. One of the other ones that you don't think about are walkaways or runaways.
Go ahead.
Like a dementia patient or something like that. And they end up in the woods. If somebody gets lost or they think they're in the woods or a pond, we get called in to do the search. So a lot of times, we have a lot of times where, the police are the initial agency call, whether it be state or a local police department, or the initial agency called, but eventually it comes to us because, they've determined that either what we like to see is as soon as they think there's a possibility that they're in the woods, they call us.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that gives us the best opportunity to find somebody before they're a casualty. But sometimes they exhaust opportunity, you know, the other other options, and then we get called in the end, and that's not, it may not give as much success. But so we do end up doing, as I say, 14% of all of our rescues are these walkaways or runaways.
That's really interesting. So most of your rescues, 60% you said, are hikers.
Are hikers, hikers and climbers.
And I did see someone hiking up Lincoln Lafayette. I am not making this up, one time, in flip-flops. So there you go. I can understand how that happens. That's really interesting. Director Mason, we've run out of time. It's really been good to talk to you today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
That's Scott Mason. He is Executive Director of New Hampshire's Fish and Game Department, first coming to the job in August of last year. Exchange listeners, we always like to hear from you. Tell us what you think about the program. You could submit ideas for future Exchange shows through our Exchange listener survey. Your feedback helps give us ideas and helps shape the future of the Exchange. Let us know your thoughts on the show at nhpr.org/surveys. Again, nhpr.org/surveys. Today's program was produced by NHPR News host and Exchange producer Jessica Hunt. Thanks everybody for being with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.